WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here in the States, many column inches have been devoted to the question of the missing weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But so far, George W. Bush has yet to feel any serious heat. Not so in the UK. Prime Minister Tony Blair is being slowly char-grilled in the fire of accusations that he used false intelligence reports to lead the country to war. The most scathing criticism of the Blair government comes from a BBC reporter named Andrew Gilligan. Gilligan claims to have spoken with a top intelligence officer who charges that Blair presented Parliament with a dossier that exaggerated the Iraqi threat. The British press has dubbed it the sexed-up dossier.
Enter Blair's director of communications, Alistair Campbell, the Ari Fleischer of England. Andrew Gilligan's secret intelligence source names Campbell as the culprit who sexed up the dossier. Now the feud between Britain's biggest broadcaster and the government has turned personal and nasty. While Campbell and Gilligan threaten each other with lawsuits, debate about the missing weapons of mass destruction has been all but lost in the furor. Trevor Butterworth is a research fellow at the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington. He laid out the details of the case.
Andrew Gilligan said that a key government dossier on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq had been made sexier by the inclusion of a piece of information which said that Saddam Hussein could deploy bioterror weapons within 45 minutes. 3 days later, in an opinion piece for the Mail on Sunday, Gilligan indicted Alistair Campbell for being the one who made sure this sexy bit of information got into the report over the objections of intelligence officers. Now, that's a, you know, that's a pretty big charge to level on the basis of a single anonymous source.
But the BBC is standing by its man, is it not?
In the sort of war of words and threats of lawsuits that have followed this event, the BBC have stuck behind Gilligan, who, of course, memorably said that the people of Iraq were now more afraid after the fall of Saddam Hussein than they were during his reign. And I guess they're gambling on one important thing, which is that there is a great public suspicion of the spin doctoring and the idea that Campbell is this unelected center of power, kind of spinning and shaping and weaving, doesn't necessarily play very well with the British public.
The BBC has made its reputation the world over for being an honest, independent broker of the news, but its style certainly seems to have changed of late. It seems to be more willing to engage in opinion-based reporting, or at least more flamboyant reporting. Is BBC changing its news values?
Well, yes, it is clearly changing its news values, and there are a couple of reasons for this. One is the fact that every person who owns a colour television in Britain must pay around $150 in tax, which goes directly to supporting the BBC. As a result, BBC programming carries no advertisements, but they are supposed to provide a certain amount of public affairs programming. Now, part of the BBC charter insists that when it comes to controversial issues, they provide impartial and accurate reporting. And for years, they were the benchmark of that neutral sort of stentorian tones of this is the news from London. However, the problem is that the BBC was once a monopoly. Now it faces huge amount of competition from other networks, which don't have the requirement to produce the same amount of public affairs broadcasting. So how do you make a news story compete with the drama? Well, you have to, for want of a better word, sex things up.
So to some extent, the new style that we're seeing on the BBC suggests a sort of ratings grab.
Exactly. One of the key examples of this that we've been exposed to in America has been the BBC documentary, Saving Private Lynch. John Kampfner, who produced this documentary, which basically accuses the Pentagon of using Jerry Bruckheimer to create its media policy, wrote in a recent opinion piece in a daily newspaper that he considered the, on the one hand, on the other hand, style of journalism to be dull and meaningless. Now, the problem with journalism that tries to be entertaining is that it isn't often very accurate. But they have, of course, played to a certain constituency in Britain, which tends to think of Republicans as dangerous lunatics and Americans as vaguely moronic, a constituency that's quite happy to trash Israel.
Do you believe that this is some sort of irrevocable decision made by the BBC and that they are headed inexorably on the path of the Fox News Channel? Or do you suppose that they might just be feeling their way in this new competitive environment and will eventually pull back a few steps to more resemble the BBC of old?
I'm not sanguine. I mean, it's really difficult to say whether the BBC are going to find a way out of this, because unless they do something to shore up standards, this is going to be a routine occurrence. And the more it becomes routine, the more the portfolio of charges grows against bias and inaccuracy, then the more the license fee is going to be in danger, which, at least for non-news affairs programming, would be a devastating loss.
Well, Trevor, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Trevor Butterworth is a research fellow at the Center for Media and Public Affairs. He joined us from Washington.
The BBC is in hot water with the state of Israel, too. At issue now is the rebroadcast of a BBC documentary that examines Israel's nuclear capability, not subject to inspection because Israel never signed a non-proliferation pact.
This mysterious complex in the Negev Desert employed thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. For years, Israel called it a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for bombs.
The BBC, says Daniel Seaman, director of Israel's government press office, is always putting Israel, quote, in some demonic context, not as a democracy fighting for survival. In light of this, Israel has decided to cut its ties with the BBC. Daniel Seaman joins me now on the line from Jerusalem. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, first off, can you explain what it means to cut ties with the BBC? What exactly does that entail?
Well, I just want to make one thing clear, that we're not talking about a boycott. So the BBC can continue maintaining offices in Israel and pursuing the stories. The cooperation that we have with the foreign press in Israel is not something that's written down in law. It's more an extension of the goodwill and the assistance of the government. And the thing is, with the BBC, they're making it very difficult for us now to extend that goodwill to them.
And that goodwill includes offering official spokesmen for BBC interviews, offering help in speeding through visas, and offering assistance through roadblocks in occupied territories. And that goodwill has, at least for the time being, been withdrawn.
Yes, to a large extent, they'll be able to do the work, but they won't, if they get stuck in any way or they encounter bureaucracy, then they will not enjoy the assistance of our office.
You said that the last straw was the network's rebroadcast about a week ago of a documentary dealing with Israel's unconventional weapons arsenal. What specifically in that documentary constituted the last straw?
In this particular program, we had seen it. It was obvious that there was no new news there. Some of the things were trying to portray Israel in a very menacing light, and not to mention a downright lie in the accusation of Israel using chemical weapons in Gaza. We decided it wasn't worth making an issue out of. But they're feeling necessary to air it again. And this following a program 2 weeks ago on the defensive fence that we're building to prevent terrorists from infiltrating Israel and murdering innocent Israeli civilians. They use this to prove that Israel has apartheid policy and is putting the Palestinians in ghettos. Before that, they aired a program on the targeted killings policy of the State of Israel, and the targeted killings were put in the perspective of Israel supposedly violating international law, never saying anything about the right to self-defense and that we're targeting ticking bombs. We finally reached a point in this particular program that we said enough is enough. We've exhausted all attempts on our part to try to reach a dialogue with the BBC, so we felt that there's no other avenue left.
But it certainly suggests by this action that the government is saying that it's not okay to criticize the State of Israel.
Not at all. That's not the issue. Israel has a free press here. Sometimes the criticisms by the local press is greater than that from outside, so that's certainly not the problem. It's depicting Israel as being a police state, as not respecting human rights, not respecting international law, or singling out Israel, which we see as the problem. And this kind of biased reporting is done almost on a daily basis by the BBC. Now, they'll always assign some kind of title to the Prime Minister of Israel. They'll call him the right wing or the general, or always make a reference to Sabra and Shatila. They don't do that when they speak about an Arab or about Yasser Arafat or the Palestinian leader. They don't say Yasser Arafat the terrorist or Yasser Arafat the murderer. They signed this to the Israeli prime minister in order to show that he's a war criminal. And this could delegitimize the State of Israel.
You know, though some would call cutting off ties with the BBC a counterproductive public relations move on the part of the government, the network isn't going to stop reporting on Israel, but now it's more likely that the government will be seen by BBC reporters as antagonistic and secretive, maybe. Not to mention the incomplete picture that could be created when there are no Israeli spokesmen or women to counter the arguments made by the Palestinian side.
Well, this could be true, but when you put it in the broader picture of things, then it's sending a clear message that we don't trust the BBC. There are Israelis on other news venues. If we continue cooperating with them, then all we're doing is giving them a fig leaf in which they can hide behind and claim objectivity.
With regard to the tone of the BBC programs, you did in one publication suggest that that tone was something akin to that of the Nazi newspaper Der Stürmer. Now, I know that you've said that you're very careful when invoking the word anti-Semitism, but in this case, the implication is clear.
Obviously, it's not an easy thing to use, and we don't use it lightly. But when you break down the program, when you, especially the last one, when you look at the images, when you look at the innuendo and insinuation in direction of the State of Israel, we as a people have been through this in the past. When I saw the program, when I saw the promos, all the alarms went off in my gut. And these are things that are happening in the Arab media. From a Western news organization, I would expect them to be particularly sensitive to the way in which they depict the Jewish state.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Seaman is director of Israel's government press office. The BBC declined to be interviewed for this story, but Mark Herlihy from the BBC's press office sent this statement. The BBC notes with regret the actions of the Israeli government in withdrawing some cooperation from BBC journalists and programs. These actions will not prevent us from continuing to cover events in Israel, the occupied territories, and the Middle East region with due professionalism and impartiality. The BBC rejects absolutely any charge of anti-Israel or anti-Semitic bias in any specific program or in its news coverage generally. We hope the government of Israel will reconsider its actions and work toward restoring the appropriate relationship with the BBC. He added that the BBC has not, as of this broadcast, received any notification from Israel that they are withdrawing their cooperation.
Coming up, the politics of hydrogen, deregulation in reverse, and when baseball metaphors attack.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Senate Commerce Committee has been busy the past 2 weeks concocting legislation to overturn much of the recent FCC ruling that relaxes media ownership regulations. Some of the rollbacks the committee voted on include returning the national audience reach cap for TV broadcasters, which had been raised to 45% by the FCC, back to 35%, and restoring the ban on one company owning several media outlets in one city. The Senate's apparent rebuke of the FCC decision has been variously hailed as momentous and delightful and derided as confusing and utterly futile. In the momentously delightful corner, Washington Post columnist Tom Shales dubbed the committee's action, quote, a victory or at least a step on the road to victory for the American people. And in the confusingly futile corner, I am joined by Cable World's Alicia Mundy. Alicia, welcome back to the show.
So I'm confusingly futile. That's me.
All right, in one word or less, does meaningful legislation canceling out the FCC's action have the slightest chance of being passed by both houses of Congress?
No, that would be no.
All right, Alicia, well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you once again. Alicia Mundy is, oh, you know what? I'll ask you more questions anyway. Tell me, please, why in your latest piece you described yourself as being in the snowball's chance in hell corner on this question.
Well, I sat through the hearing that they held on this latest piece of rollback legislation, and I've never seen so many born-again regulators out of a group of free marketers. This bill, I think, is what we call legislation by public relations. It is freighted with so much baggage, it has to sink of its own weight. One of these provisions, for instance, would take existing radio stations away from Clear Channel. Now, Clear Channel right now is the poster child of media consolidation and what's wrong with big media companies. But nonetheless, you don't take away a station from a company that bought it legally and out in the open. You can't do that. I mean, it's like Mr. Rogers. Boys and girls, can you say constitutional challenge?
And let's make the point here that this is not one piece of proposed legislation, but two. Tell me what the second bill has within it and what its chances of passage actually are.
The second bill does have a very good chance of passage. It's the basic reauthorization bill for the budget for the FCC. And that's the one that contains the provision that rolls back the two-year review to 4 years. But the first bill contains the really good language that gives the FCC the right to re-regulate as well as deregulate in the public interest. That, unfortunately, is stuck into the bill that contains, you know, every item in the kitchen sink.
Okay, now, if you're right and that this proposed legislation is a sort of window dressing, why are the senators on the Commerce Committee going through with this exercise to begin with?
Part of it is that they didn't expect the public reaction that they got. Until 6 months ago, really, when Michael Copps began pushing this whole issue and trying to demand public hearings, nobody except for 200 lobbyists and a bunch of media moguls even had any idea what was really going on. Members of the Senate did, but they don't count here, of course. And they did not expect a public outcry. They didn't expect to have William Sapphire coming at them with both barrels. So now they're trying to suddenly say, gee, we didn't expect this to happen. And this is silly. They've had every chance they could in the last couple of years to stop the FCC. Basically, they're like people who have suddenly been hit with a paternity suit, and they're saying, I have no idea what you're talking about. I never had sex with this person. It's ridiculous. This is their baby.
But in fact, in your latest piece, you say there is a DNA evidence of the senator's complicity, including that of committee chairman John McCain. You say the proof is in a tiny addendum to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, known as Section 202H. What is Section 202H?
It's a very tiny little provision that says the FCC must review its ownership rules of the media every 2 years, and it must get rid of any rule that it can no longer justify as being in the public interest. They figured that what they couldn't get put into the Telecom Act directly in print and chiseled in stone, they'd get a second chance to have when the FCC had to review all of its ownership rules and justify every single one of them. And these senators voted for that language.
Is it possible, Alicia, that notwithstanding the kind of PR tactics that you say the Commerce Committee is employing, that the FCC and the committee itself have unleashed a force that will trigger a series of events that even the estimable John McCain cannot control?
I think it's entirely possible that this crazy bill in various forms will wend its way through, and even though I think that it will be killed in the House by Billy Tozan, if Tozan again were to step aside, then something could happen, and then they're going to have to deal with it because they will have court challenges from all of the companies, it will be held up forever, and eventually all they end up is with egg on their faces and your average taxpayer wondering, well, what did we just pay for the FCC to do for the past 2 years? Wasn't this just a waste of money and effort?
So would you want to change your analysis to say maybe not a snowball's chance in hell, but a snowball's chance in purgatory?
In purgatory. Let's put it in purgatory.
All right, Alicia. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Alicia Mundy is a fellow at the New America Foundation and a senior editor for Cable World.
As you sail down the highway this weekend, fill her up. The Energy Information Administration announced on Wednesday that, quote, even if the summer driving season does begin in earnest following the July 4th holiday, as possibly evident by the record 9.5 million barrel level of gasoline demand last week, supplies are expected to be adequate for the remainder of the travel season. But not forever, which is why last week President Bush and the European Council issued a joint statement underscoring their commitment to a hydrogen economy fueled in part by hydrogen-powered cars. As the president said back in January in his State of the Union address,
with a new national commitment, our scientists and engineers will overcome obstacles to taking these cars from laboratory to showroom.
Our growing oil use threatens the nation's economic, environmental, and geopolitical health. So hydrogen looms large in the media, alternately portrayed as savior, band-aid, and red herring. Here to unmask this very political element is Dr. Daniel Kamen, professor in the Energy and Resources Group at the University of California at Berkeley. Dan, welcome to On the Media.
Well, thank you.
So let's start with the hardest part. Hydrogen is not a renewable source of energy like wind or water, and it's not a fossil fuel like oil or coal. It's not even accessible. It's bound up in water. So how does it even work as a fuel?
Well, it's bound up in water, but it also is the most common element in the universe. And hydrogen atoms, when you separate them, give off a lot of energy. And so hydrogen is an excellent source of fuel, but it is one that you need to prepare. You need to get it in the right form, and that does take energy.
In other words, you have to use energy to get the energy, and that's where a lot of the controversy is now. How do you get the energy? Where do you get it from? Do you get it from oil?
Well, that's right. It's a point of scientific debate, but it's also a point where hydrogen as a fuel, or more accurately, as an energy carrier, is something that's debated in the media, sometimes accurately and sometimes inaccurately. You get it from all kinds of sources. Today, we produce lots and lots of excess hydrogen from refining hydrocarbons into gasoline. So we have an abundant source today, but most people who think about a hydrogen economy are thinking down the road when we wouldn't use fossil fuels to get our hydrogen, which sounds sort of backwards. We would use clean sources of energy to separate the hydrogen from the oxygen and give us that hydrogen fuel we want.
When you read articles about the issue of hydrogen and the issue of hydrogen cars, do you think that it's being given a full and fair treatment, or do you think that the reporters are being buffeted by various political winds?
Well, I certainly think that the reporters are getting very disparate views on what hydrogen vehicles might do. But this is not a case where I think the media is doing a disservice. I think this is a case where the scientific and the policy debate is going at loggerheads, and that the reporters are simply trying to do a good job in reporting that.
Do you mean that essentially the policies that are emanating from Washington don't really make sense in terms of science? And so when reporters are writing this story, a mixed message is invariably sent? Or am I putting words in your mouth?
No, I think I agree with that completely. The policies we're seeing from Washington on hydrogen are ones that ask us to hold our breath, keep going with the fossil fuel economy for quite a number of years, and then hope our science generates some wonderful hydrogen solutions 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 years from now. As opposed to what the science says is that we have ways to use hydrogen well today. You can have small fuel cells to run your car. You can have fuel cells in the basement of your home or business that can generate electricity for you. And when you're not using them, for example, in your business, you can then sell power into the grid. That's a good use of hydrogen today. And it's one that builds what I would consider energy security, meaning that it helps to diversify our energy mix away from fossil fuels. That story, I actually think, is one piece that has not been covered well in the media. And the reason is that it's not a very simple story to tell. What I'm basically saying is that the best energy policy isn't one that looks for some great innovation, cold fusion or 100% nuclear power or 100% hydrogen, but it's one where a more diverse set of resources is going to win the day. And that's the kind of story that's like washing paint dry. It doesn't sell newspapers, as opposed to saying, researchers in Utah have developed cold fusion. We can all use as much energy as we want.
Amory Lovins wrote a recent white paper called 20 Hydrogen Myths. He said of hydrogen's critics, some are skeptical because the president endorsed it, others because environmentalists did.
I wouldn't characterize it quite the way Amory did. I think that the number of myths out there about hydrogen are very large, and that correcting those is the job of scientists and then the media to transmit that message. But the real undercurrent here is that hydrogen as an energy carrier threatens what is the biggest business in America, and that is the petrochemical industry. And so every time we think about ways to build out the market for fuel cell cars, hydrogen fuel cells in your basement, all kinds of things that make sense, we see real people who may be losers, GM and Ford, unless they get on the hydrogen bandwagon, may be losers in that. And the winners are likely to be smaller startups that don't have a constituency yet. So I think that you are seeing much more a battle between those who are making money today and those who might make money down the road.
And that's why you can be in the peculiar position of supporting the development of hydrogen cars and opposing the policy by which the president means to develop it.
That's right.
Okay, so what's the media to do?
Well, I think that the number one thing is that the United States does not engage in much at all of a debate about energy policy. For example, right now, the House and Senate are debating major energy bills, and those deserve huge amounts of coverage. But I think that the real approach is that energy should be a frontline item for national campaigns. And recently, several of the Democratic candidates have rolled out bits of different energy platforms. Gephardt has Apollo 21, Kerry just did his, et cetera. But the real issue is that people aren't letting the public know how central our energy decisions are to almost everything else in the economy.
All right. Dr. Kamen, thank you so much.
Sure enough.
Dr. Daniel Kamen joined me from the University of California at Berkeley. There are two things about Garfield you need to know. First of all, he's an unreconstructed baseball fan, following the fortunes of his beloved Philadelphia Phillies, mostly into catastrophe, for 40-some years. The second thing is, in his other life, he makes a living as a critic of advertising. And each year, around baseball's All-Star break, his twin obsessions converge to drive him nuts. Here's a fulmination of his from a couple of baseball seasons back.
Listening to an ad on a classical music radio station sounds like this.
It's called the Lexus Golden Opportunity. You have until September 4th to get the one that didn't get away.
Listening to an ad on an all-news radio station sounds like this.
Well, you'll feel even worse tomorrow morning if you miss Sleepy's one-day sale.
Listening to an ad on a baseball game sounds like this.
Hello?
Pokey, where are you? We're almost done with warm-ups. You're going to miss BP.
This is better than batting practice, Coach. I'm downloading the opposing pitcher's stats.
You mean you don't have Adelphia's power link?
Where is it inscribed that baseball game advertising copy must invoke baseball themes and imagery? Hank Greenwald, retired voice of the San Francisco Giants, spent years reading the worst writing on God's green outfield.
Here are the stolen base leaders in the National League, and this feature is brought to you by some burglar alarm company. Don't let anyone steal your prized possessions, you know, or you'll hit a home run every time when you bank with such and such. They're corny, and a lot of times you kind of cringe when you hear them.
Grand slam this, strike out that. Hockey game ads don't talk about slap shots and cross checks. Traffic report advertising doesn't trot out bumper-to-bumper gags. So how in the world do you explain this?
Swing and a long drive. Watch
I've seen plenty of big hits in my days. No hit, though, could match the one Sue Tierney of Philadelphia made during her family reunion. Sue excited that crowd of aunts, uncles, and second cousins with a grand slam meal of hot dogs and hamburgers served on delicious Stroman rolls. So make a big hit of your own with Stroman hot dog and hamburger roll.
The voice belongs to Philadelphia Phillies play-by-play man Harry Callis, one of the most admired broadcasters in baseball, which is one of the reasons the situation is so pathetic. Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Frank Fitzpatrick not only cringes, but feels a deep and abiding sadness to hear so distinguished an announcer reduced to mouthing such insipid and misinformed blather.
There's one of these ads that's like fingernails on a blackboard to me. It's another Stroman's ad, and Harry says, I've seen many great Phillies teams over the years, and I'm thinking, no, you haven't. I mean, they've only had five pennant winners in in 117 years.
He's right, of course. The Phillies are by far the losingest franchise in the history of professional sports. But Frank veers off the point, which is that what the hell do great Phillies teams have to do with hot dog buns?
I think most of the imagery is just so cliched that they feel like no matter what bad pun or play on words they
and
make, people are going.
Forget it, Frank. I'll tell you what it has to do with hot dog buns. It doesn't have anything to do with hot dog buns. At long last, what kind of sensibility is behind this reflexive reference in the advertising to the programming that surrounds it? Pitching stats and cable modems? Who writes this stuff?
Well, obviously, knowing that this was going to be broadcast during the Dodger games, you want that type of a tie-in.
Michael Knight is marketing manager for the Adelphia Cable System's PowerLink high-speed internet service. He doesn't use an ad agency. He himself authored the pitcher spot that Adelphia runs on Dodgers games.
Major sports, say a football and a basketball, which probably wouldn't have come as easy to me to create an ad that would flow. Baseball just has that natural flow to it.
Right, that natural flow. And there's your answer. Baseball ads sound the way they do because they are being penned by high-speed internet service marketing managers. Local radio ads are the single-A bush leagues of copywriting. But the thing is, you don't have to be peddling cable service or doughy picnic items to sound pitiful in your attempt to hit one out of the park with the consumer. In one Hall of Fame moment from a couple summers back, one bonus baby went into his windup and delivered this pitch.
When a shortstop drops the ball on a sure double play, he tells you, my error, there's no finger pointing. So how come on a big thing like poor math and reading scores, no one in the school system has ever said, hey, it's my fault? Well, elect Mike Bloomberg mayor. Give him the assignment. He'll be accountable. Mike Bloomberg, he'll deliver.
Paid for by Bloomberg for mayor.
Unfortunately for Mike Bloomberg, his tortured baseball imagery didn't prevent him from being elected mayor of New York City, because now he is confronted each day with two embarrassing failures: the city's still dysfunctional schools, and more humiliating still, the New York Mets.
Coming up, Al Jazeera from the inside and anthems for the corporate man.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After 9/11 and straight through the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we've examined the role of the influential Arabic news service Al Jazeera. It's influential because it's seen as an unprecedented independent voice in the region, even as it's viewed as a pro-Arab version of Fox News by many in the West. Next Thursday, the PBS series Wide Angle takes the viewer inside Al Jazeera during the war in Iraq, as it was condemned in turn by the United States, the United Kingdom, and what was left of the government of Iraq. David Belton is the executive producer of the Wide Angle documentary called Exclusive to Al Jazeera, and he joins me by phone from London. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke, very much indeed. Nice to be with you.
What kind of a reaction did you get? Were they eager for you to come in and be the fly on the wall?
Yeah, they were. I mean, there was a certain amount of wariness initially, just in terms of the perspective that they thought we might have about their broadcasting. But I think over the course of a week that I was there, we established a very good bond.
So Al Jazeera was all too aware of the complaints from its critics around the world that it had a pro-Arab slant.
Well, Al Jazeera is aware of critics from both sides. I mean, they have just as many complaints from their Arab neighbors as they do from Western countries. In fact, there were, when I was out there in February, they had no bureau in Jordan or Kuwait. They had been thrown out by both governments for what the Kuwaitis and the Jordanians believed was anti-Arab reporting.
Al Jazeera found itself embroiled in controversy over its decision to broadcast images of dead and wounded U.S. soldiers and then British soldiers.
They weren't pretty, but what they showed consistently. At the BBC, we have very strict guidelines about that kind of thing. Al Jazeera have a different set of guidelines. The question is, are we producing news that is getting closer to the truth by not showing those images, or are Al Jazeera getting closer to the truth? Now, we deliberately didn't answer that question. We very much left it for the viewer to make up their own mind.
You may not have asked it, but Ibrahim Halal actually answered it.
What we are doing is just showing the reality. We didn't invent the bodies. We didn't made them in the graphics unit. These are the shots coming from the field. I know there are millions of shots we cannot get and will never get. But at least whatever we have to show to the whole world. This is a war.
Yeah, I mean, I think he says it extremely well. My only proviso on what he said is that Al Jazeera is a commercial broadcaster, and there is absolutely no doubt that it wants to get exclusives, it wants to make the news. And I suspect, like any commercial broadcaster, that plays into the decision.
I know that once the war began, we saw in your documentary that Al Jazeera's exclusive images didn't remain exclusive for long. Other networks, including Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV, took its war footage without acknowledging that it was Al Jazeera's and plunked it on its own network. In fact, here we have a clip of Omar Beck, the chief of news gathering, calling Sky News to object.
This one you're taking off air. Nobody gave you any clear guidance on this. No one. You have no right to do so. This is by far piracy. At least you should pick up the phone and call me. This is my material. I don't use your material. We're an international TV organization. We're not just a local any TV.
Well, I thought that was one of the most important bits that we got in the entire film, because I think it absolutely summed up a sense that they want to play in the big league and they have a right to be there. And it's no good some other news organization coming along and nicking stuff of theirs, stealing stuff of theirs, I should say. I think it's also quite revealing for any audience to see just what the news game is all about.
While you're in the process of putting your documentary together, did you find that your opinions toward Al Jazeera changed? What was your opinion when you started and when you ended?
I suppose part of me arrived in Qatar with a little bit of skepticism about what I was likely to see. And I think one of the things that became clear was that despite the pressure they received from both Western government and from the Iraqi government, they weren't prepared to budge. They were absolutely determined to stick to their essential editorial principles.
Well, let's talk about some of the pressure that they came under from all sides in the war. The decision to air the images of the POWs had consequences. In the United States, the New York Stock Exchange jettisoned the Al Jazeera correspondents, and then their website was sabotaged. And then finally, the Iraqi government, or at least the visible part that was left, the stalwart Minister of Information, said he wanted a couple of Al Jazeera reporters to leave, and Al Jazeera's response was to threaten to close down their entire Iraqi operation. They went sort of nose to nose with the Iraqi government, and the Iraqi government backed down.
They are good at that. They have plenty of experience of squaring up against governments and They'd done it in the past, and there was nothing that was going to stop them from doing it this time.
On the other hand, just because you're courageous doesn't mean you're fair and balanced. All through the documentary, Al Jazeera staff and management talk about their commitment to the job, but you also know that they're feeling a pull, a personal loyalty. There's the example of Riyad, the cameraman from Iraq, who said, and you'll hear in this clip, he would have been willing to put down his camera and pick up a gun.
If they will destroy everything in Baghdad, I think I will fight. I forget the camera and I'll fight my gun because it's my country.
Obviously, any Western reporter would say, you know, that is wildly inappropriate. If you're there as a reporter, you can't be there as a combatant.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think Riyadh was a bit of a one-off, but I think you're right. What he was talking about specifically was if Baghdad was leveled, that would be the moment when he wasn't sure that he could do his job anymore. You know, I certainly don't make excuses for that. It's not the way journalists should be. At the same time, just as a human being watching your city being destroyed, I don't know. I don't know how I'd feel. I suppose we'd all like to, in our essays at journalism college or whatever, be able to say how we'd be in that situation. Maybe he was being so candidly honest in a way that perhaps we're sort of obliged not to, but perhaps might feel.
On this program, we've talked to a number of people over the last year and a half who have criticized Al Jazeera for being needlessly inflammatory in its promotional announcements and in its reports. This may be a news organization with the best intentions, but do you really think they're there yet or anywhere close to where they ought to be if they want to be considered in the same league with, say, the BBC or CNN? And let's face it, those organizations have come under fire recently as well.
We all come under fire, don't we? And sometimes we get it wrong. And I'm not an official spokesman for Al Jazeera. What I can say is that in the 4 weeks that we followed them during the recent war in Iraq, we saw rigorous journalism. Yeah, the images that they put out at times were inflammatory, often to Western eyes. I don't know. How many times do we consider footage that we put out of injured Iraqi children on our channels in Britain or in America and consider that to be inflammatory? I sound like an official spokesman for Al Jazeera, and I really don't mean to be. I'm just merely speaking with objectivity and impartiality, he says, having just been them and the way they do their job.
David, thanks a lot.
Okay, Brooke, nice to talk to you.
David Belton is the executive producer of the wide-angle documentary exclusive to Al Jazeera, which airs on Thursday, July 10th on PBS.
This spring, ZDNet UK reposted some selected corporate anthems online, so you can download the bouncy inspirational tunes of Sun Microsystems, Honeywell, and Apple. Corporate anthems are geared not to customers, but to company staff, like the one once singled out by Britain's Guardian newspaper for the global consulting giant KPMG, extolling the virtues of chartered accountants. "Welcome to musical hell," the rather fractious writer began, "a place where men and women trilled glutinous couplets about teamwork and customer care and vainglorious paeans to company spirit." And that is in understated England. Here in the USA, our corporate leviathans took the form right over the top. For your delectation, this OTM classic from our very own Rex Doan.
Early corporate anthems, like this one for IBM, sounded more like fight songs for someone's dear old alma mater than anything else. But by the 1950s, mere song and verse gave way to big, brassy industrial shows with multiple musical numbers dedicated to pushing product.
Standing on the corner, watching all the Fords go by. Standing on the corner, giving all the Fords the eye.
Steve Young is a writer for The Late Show with David Letterman and is the foremost collector and researcher of industrial show souvenir albums.
They were very lavishly produced Broadway-style reviews, often using legitimate Broadway talent and name-brand composers to to put on a whole musical to motivate the sales force, and not only just inspire them to sell, but also inspire them to feel good about the way of life they've chosen.
Coca-Cola, daily gaining in strength, drawn from the experience of the past and the opportunities of the here and now.
Some of the big corporations like GM and Coca-Cola have a lot of very bombastic material that goes beyond just details about the product that may be at hand, but giving you a much more overarching view of this. This is more than just a product that we're selling. We're existing on a much higher plane. We're the backbone of the free world. We're the reason that life is worth living, that sort of thing. You see a lot of that in Coca-Cola shows.
Coca-Cola, here and now, wherever you may be. From the Empire State to the Golden Gate, from sea to shining sea.
And this is the sort of thing that would bring tears to the eyes of grown-up sales executives sitting in the audience.
In addition to writing songs that appear in such major films as Shane and Sabrina, Wilson Stone penned Coca-Cola's Here and Now, along with several other industrial show tunes for corporations like Chevrolet, Cadillac, and Xerox. Stone was drawn to writing industrial shows for the familiar reasons.
We would have a cast of 30 people and a 60-piece orchestra. You know, they were huge. And most of the, we really used all Broadway people because they paid so much money. So we all did it. Just for the money.
The size and budget that industrial shows used to boast still amazes Hank Beebe, who worked in the field for over 20 years.
Well, the only figures I remember are the ones for the first show, which was in 56 for the 57 line. And that show was budgeted at six times the cost of bringing My Fair Lady to Broadway that same year.
Proud, proud, Chevrolet, proud.
By Beebe's math, that means that the 1957 Chevrolet Extravaganza carried a price tag of over $3 million, a considerable sum to be sure, but perhaps deserved.
It's an easy thing to write a song about love. It's hard to write a song about spark plugs.
How it feels to feel Chevrolet proud, bright broad banners everywhere.
Indeed, the lyrical content of many industrial show songs bordered on the bizarre. Again, Steve Young.
The Bathrooms Are Coming is from 1969 from the American Standard Company, and it's pretty much got everything you could want in an industrial show. It's got a song called My Bathroom, which is a sort of wonderful tribute to a woman's bathroom and how much it means to her.
My bathroom is a private kind of place. Very special kind of place. The only place where I can stay, making faces at my face. My bathroom.
Like some traveling production of Cabaret for Carburetors, many of the industrial shows even toured from city to city for regional sales meetings. But by the mid-1980s, the light would dim on the industrial show. Bloated budgets and the emergence of multimedia presentations silenced the corporate chorus line. So today, the only place the industrial show lives on is in the living room of collector Steve Young, a fact that makes one wonder about the cumulative effects of listening to the over 150 industrial show albums that are in the possession of this sub-subgenre's sole archivist.
I wouldn't say I've been brainwashed by listening to these songs, but I feel like, boy, I really like Massey Ferguson tractors now. I've never been on a tractor in my life, but boy, I'd be proud to own one. I'd be proud to sell and service one.
She's a driving rain and the wind on the plain. She's as hard as a Midwest winter. And there's no halfway when you're feeding the world. There's just no room for beginners. You hold the key to the land of the free, and you know the power is in her. So stand up proud and say it loud. This is the world of winners. Sing it!
Yes, we're Massey.
Massey's number one.
For On the Media in New York, I'm Rex Doan.
You're the man with the power in your hand.
So stand up proud and say it loud.
With Massey Ferguson.
Yeah!
There's media all around us. Media big and small.
There are media that are hard to kill, like in that movie by Seagal.
There's so much media everywhere, it's hard to find relief.
There's media in the food we eat and in the air we breathe.
I don't know what you're saying, but I know this much is true.
Our name is On the Media, and we're the show for you.
On the Media!
Tune it in and turn it on.
On the Media!
We've got the Punditron.
On the Media!
We're your media watchdog.
On the Media!
At onthemedia.org.
Media,
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 media
deserves a second look.
Media,
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 media.
That's why you've got Bob and Brooke.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Sean Landis, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and Bill O'Neill, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Blake Carlton and Josh Keating. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Mike Pesca wrote the OTM corporate anthem with help from composer John Dryden.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.